Hi, my name is Sean Aladio, and I'm 58 years old. Today, I think today is September. Let me look at this iPad here. Oh, it's September 24th, 2019. Oh my gosh, where's time going? So today, I'm speaking a little bit about my family and how I came to be an American. I live in Orange County in California, in the city of Tustin, but I was raised up in Pacific Grove, Carmel, Salinas, here we go, it's a long list, and then Santa Ana. And I graduated from Santa Ana High School in 1979. Go Saints! So my story kind of begins many, many generations ago, like most of ours. And my ancestors came to America 15 generations ago, long time ago. We ended up coming over here before this country had been beyond a colony. We were part of the original Swedish colony that was in the Rhode Island area and several other emerging, you know, kind of like, who's going to get this property and take it over and run it? So my family's kind of got an interesting history. We had a Scottish ancestor from the Isle of Man who was a captain, and he was in some problems in war, and he was captured by the British and brought over here as an indentured servant, as we call him. But he basically was a slave for about 17 years. So as my family kind of propagated forward, we had several stories of this. Even our Swedish ancestor, really interestingly enough, he was in prison in Sweden, and he was taken out of prison and brought over here on a ship called the Nickel, N-Y-C-K-E-L. And he was part of a somewhat failed colony and got his freedom and became part of this movement. So I'm kind of an offshoot of that. So from that many generations back to as recent as three generations on the Italian and Irish side of my family, we have quite a diverse background coming into this nation, which is actually really exciting because this is a nation of immigrants, and definitely my family reflects that. So speeding up a little bit, I'm going to bounce around slightly, and what does that mean to me and to my family? I love genetics in terms of DNA, and of course, what is our family tree? Fortunately for me, a lot of my family members have a keen interest in our genealogy, and we have a really wonderful family tree that's been put together. And when we went out and did our 23andMe DNA test, that kind of solidified a lot of the oral history that had relatively been kept intact from around the 1500s forward. So we were pretty fortunate that our forebears here in America who had emigrated to this country did not lose a lot of the remembrance of the old country. And interestingly enough, with that, a lot of the behaviors that we have kind of became embedded in the family. One of them being, you work a good honest day's work. So you put your best into every single day and you reap the rewards of that. My mom always told me that life is tragedy, and it's difficult, and it's suffering, and then you make the beauty out of that. My mom's name was Diana, and she had a really great way of looking at life as it's a matter of fact. And my mom's attitude was you had to be a little tough for it. And she always told me two things that really stood out that I didn't really like very much when she was saying it. And one was, Sean, get over yourself. And the other one was, when I was complaining about something, she'd turn to me and she'd say, well, life ain't for pussies. And yeah, she was actually right. Getting back on track with my family, I'm going to speed it up to how we came to Orange County. On my mother's side, which is the Czechoslovakian Bohemian area, Korol family, or the Korolova family. My great-grandfather, Joseph Korol, came to America to escape communism. We had ancestral lands for many generations. They had farms, a butcher shop, a bank, a hotel, etc. When the communists came in, it was a very difficult time because that's when family members were turning family members in and everybody was watching everybody. And my great-grandpa Joseph was going to have none of that crap. He made a plan that after he served in the Prussian War as an officer, that he would find the gold streets of America and he would get to America somehow. So after the lands got confiscated, it was a very difficult time because there wasn't a lot of money available, cash in hand. And coming into America, usually in those days, and I guess even today, an immigrant would send one family member ahead and they would set up a homestead, a house, get a job, and send for the rest of the family if they couldn't immigrate together. So when the rest of the family came, when they'd come through Ellis Island, they had to pass. They had to have money in hand, number one. They had to have somebody here that would sponsor them. But they also had to be in good health. We did have two family members that made it to Ellis Island, but they were sick, and they were turned back. They were not allowed entry into the United States. It took them several years in the future to be able to make it to see the Statue of Liberty as the great European migration. And that was also part of the Irish side of my family that came from the potato famine. So with that, how I ended up in this amazing country with all these opportunities as a woman is because all these people behind me and behind you gave us this hope to be anything that we wanted to be, to dream, but not to dream, but to be. And I'm definitely a result of that. So I have a lot of love and gratitude for this country and that it was built on a plan of having respect spiritually for others and based on the precept of a Christian God at the time so that we could try to overcome our pitfalls, because certainly most of the people that were coming to America were trying to leave. They were either brought here against their will or they were trying to leave oppression or areas where they lacked opportunity. So America was like the big hope. It was the big, you know, the American dream was real. They would say that the streets were paved in gold, and that was just like so much for like a peasant. Oh my gosh, can you imagine if they really thought that was true? And they did. And my family was part of that. My mother's mother and father met in Santa Ana at Santa Ana High School. My great-grandpa came to Santa Ana around 1910, 1909, around that time, and he purchased land in part of the area of the Back Bay Estuary of Newport Beach. If you're familiar with Orange County, you can pull up a map, an aerial map or a Google map, and you can kind of look at the terrain there. But there's this amazing estuary that has been somewhat controlled. But the area where you would see the Tustin hangars that the Navy owns, these two big dirigible air hangars, that actually used to be like kind of swampland, and they drained a lot of the water out of that area, that wetlands area, so that the weight of these hangars could be taken upon in the land. So my great-grandpa followed a lot of Czechoslovakians, and they would basically make up communities, and there was an area that was called Glorieta. And Glorieta was a part of Santa Ana that today is now called Delhi. The address that my great-grandpa used on all the mail that they had from Czechoslovakia is listed as Glorieta. The land that grandpa bought was really cheap, paid cash for it in hand, and he built a one-room clapboard house on Flora Street, which is, you know, you can't imagine that today because they eventually had 11 kids. So the boys would sleep out in the outbuildings in the barns. They didn't have running plumbing. They didn't have electricity in those days. So the land that he bought then for the family farm was off of MacArthur and Red Hill Avenue in Tustin. And that was right on the border. So that was the farmland. And the farmland was really cheap because it had a lot of salt in it from the estuary that had been drained. So the things that would grow really good in the land there were lima beans and alfalfa and beets. And there was a sugar beet factory. And at the sugar beet factory in Santa Ana, my great-grandpa Joseph became the foreman there that would make all the kilns. And he would travel up to Spreckles in Salinas, and he would work on the kilns up there. So a lot of sugar beets were grown, and there was quite a distinct smell in the air up until the 70s when the sugar beet factory was still producing. So for 50 years, he was a foreman there. So that's how he got the land. So it's really interesting when you think about, you know, where you are now, you look around now and you have to go back in time to really appreciate what was there before you came, before everything got paved or turned over or reassigned, basically, for progress. So with that, where my grandma and grandpa come in is World War II took off, and right before that, my grandfather was a Sea Scout, Byron Fletcher Quivy, and his father was also Byron Fletcher Quivy. He was a teacher, so we had a lot of generations that went to Santa Ana High School. I went to Santa Ana High School. My mom went to Santa Ana High School. My uncle Byron Walter went to Santa Ana High School. My brother went to Santa Ana High School. Both my grandparents, all my aunts and uncles, all my cousins went to Santa Ana High School, and my great-grandpa. So quite a few generations. My youngest daughter, Shania, is going to Tustin High School, which is not too far away. And my oldest daughter, Kyla, did not go to the schools here. We lived in a different area. So what is kind of interesting about that is that my uncle, Bomo Coral, there's a park named after him in Santa Ana called Bomo Coral Park. And he was the guy that took over this with other people, of course. He was a park superintendent for Santa Ana, and he was a really famous ball player and a football player in Orange County and a coach. And so was his brother, Joe Coral, who became a teacher at Willard Junior High School. So the family has a pretty amazing background, plus with all the cousins. They all married out of high school in Santa Ana High School, and it just... it's amazing what these people did. My Uncle Warren Hamilton married my Aunt Jeanette Coral, and he started working in the movies with MGM Studios. He started working on the silent movies in the 20s, 1925, and then he migrated to the talkies, and he went on to work on set design. And we have four generations of film movie industry family members that are working on set design and editing for sound. And so Warren Ray Hamilton worked on Gone with the Wind. He worked on Wizard of Oz, a lot of movies. You can check them out. But he worked on over 200 feature films. And he also did 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. So he did all the sets and all the really cool effects. And his son, Warren Ray, also got into the movies. And he worked on hundreds of movies and another amazing career. And then his son works for Warner Brothers. And so we have a very creative family. They're very, you know, they were able to pursue their creativity and do great things in this country that may not have happened in the old country. So in a lot of ways, wow, we got the gold ticket, didn't we? Grandpa was in the Sea Scouts out of Long Beach and Newport. And there was a ship, the SS Stranger, that he was on board with a crew, and they ended up doing a cruise up to Alaska. They went to Shisharef. They went all over to Nome, and he had a great adventure, and he had a great love for the ocean, which he ended up having a sailboat down at Dana Point. And I would ride my bicycle from Santa Ana to Dana Point on the weekends and then go sailing with him out to Catalina Island. So my grandpa introduced me to the big wide open of the ocean, which became influential in my later years. But also, my grandpa had a shop on Main Street and in Santa Ana. And the Main Street shop, 2324, I believe it was, South Main Street, was an Art Deco building where shaving cream was made. And it's a very distinct building, but what took place there happened after World War II. Grandpa joined the military. He wanted to be a pilot, but he ended up being a mechanic. He worked on Corsair engines, and he worked on the fighter planes, the bombers. He was sent to North Africa with the Army Air Corps and to Italy. He was in Italy, actually, when Mount Vesuvius blew and ruined all their bomber planes and took a bunch of really amazing photos, which you can see online. What's really cool about this is that Grandpa was an artist before that, an amazing artist. So his hands had never really been greasy, you know. He was not the guy that would grab the wrench, etc. But that trip to on the SS Stranger with the Sea Scouts started to open up possibilities. The military gave him the skills to be able to do something far outside of being an artist. So then what happened with Grandpa is after World War II, like all the men, they came back home. And the first thing was that the women came out of the factory, went back into the household, and the men then took over those roles that they had left behind. My grandfather bought a Flying A gas station, which is the one we talked about earlier, and the one with the shaving cream building. It's a really cool building, Art Deco. And all the guys that came out of World War II, like any war, they are exposed to something that can be quite sinister and spiritual and kind of an awakening about how evil humanity can be, and also how important it is to protect society and to protect democracy and freedom. So it really is a struggle against our good versus our bad, which we struggle with all day long, even with our neighbors. It's just a bigger front. So when Grandpa came back, you know, when men and women as well get exposed to these incredible situations that push you beyond determination and scope and really test who you are, maybe even your personal values, your spiritual values, but also the amount of adventure that they get and the training that they get, and they get to see places they never would have seen again. And they get to kind of have like a dimensional awakening in some sense. So when Grandpa came back, he got into the gas station, and then, well, he was building engines and working on engines, so here he started to do the same thing. After World War II, the car racing blew up in America. All these World War II veterans were starting to wrench on little midget cars, race cars. They would make them in their garages and their driveways, and they'd go to the fairgrounds on the weekend. And all across the country, midget racing was like out of control, cool. It was really cool. So Grandpa, one of his really good friends, Briggs Cunningham, Carol Shelby was a friend of his. All those guys that were veterans came back and they started to push it because they were driven. They already had an experience where they were challenged to go beyond the norm. And they definitely did it with muscle cars. So Grandpa became a wheelwright. He started making midget cars, and then he started making Formula Four and Formula Five cars and racing, and he raced at the Diego Ravine, the Garcia Ravine, where you now have the Los Angeles Coliseum. You raced down at Del Mar, RIR, Riverside International Raceway, all over the United States to Florida and back. He would get on the weekend with all these men and their families, their girls, their wives, their grandkids, and they go to the racetracks. And so it was on. Even here, Santa Ana Airport was doing drag racing. We had the OCIR, the Orange County International Racetrack, right off the I-5 here in Irvine. That was a place I'd go to in high school. Then we had dirt bikes coming up after that as well, when the motorcycle scene started to build. So the power was on, man. The race for horsepower is on. And America has an amazing love affair with vehicles. And so I grew up in that. And I was exposed to that because of my grandfather's experiences. And the military gave him the capability to be able to build and to design and to repair and to be creative. So, again, we get back to creativity, opportunity, and, boy, you can do anything. And in America, we sure do that the best. So when I was growing up here in Orange County at the shop, I'd go and help my grandma Helen and my grandpa Byron at the shop. And my grandpa had a really good friend of his who was a polymer chemist. And grandpa was a wheelwright. And he also was one of the major importers of Pirelli tires. And Grandpa was in a lot, featured in a lot of hot rod magazines. He was also one of the founding members of the Orange County Automobile Museum, which is now no longer here. But there is the Marconi Museum. You got to go check that out in Tustin. It's amazing if you like cars. So Grandpa got together with his friend, and his friend had made this product that was really interesting to my grandpa. My grandpa encouraged him to keep producing it and get it going. And so down at the shop on Main Street, the Quivy Tire Service in Santa Ana, they started testing this product, and they decided that they would start marketing it. And I remember they'd take ads out in Hot Rod or magazine in the very back. In those days, that was the way to get your product out to the public. And there were 55-gallon drums with a little hand pump in one of the back rooms with boxes and little bottles and stickers and on and on and on and, you know, all that stuff you need to ship stuff. So my grandma and I would go back and we would pump into these small little bottles this product called No Dirt, and we would basically go to the post office every single day and ship this stuff out. There was a gentleman that got a hold of it and realized that, you know, through the museum, that this was an amazing product because it made the tires look really shiny and new. Well, VIP products got involved. It didn't go so well with the owners. The original owners didn't really. There was four of them. My grandpa was one of the four. My grandpa was the one that really pushed it and pushed the sales. And then this other gentleman came in and kind of took it over. He's the one that cashed it out, made all the money. VIP products, very important products. And they then took this product and redeveloped it and marketed it into what is now today known as Armor All. And so that took place in Santa Ana here in Orange County. Armor All got going there from these four people and my grandpa's friend who created the product. And I was the one with the little sticky fingers putting those stickers on and going to the stupid post office every day, and I could not stand it. And my grandma didn't like it anymore. So that was the origins, the true history of Armor All. And from there, I got to help Grandpa with the tank in the day to clean all the parts, like the acetone wash tank. Yeah, I would do that. So I would get all the parts and clean them. So I was not afraid to be around horsepower. Grandpa had engine blocks everywhere. He had a race car at his house he'd work on. And I was so enamored by it. All I wanted to do was buy a dirt bike. So I bought a dirt bike before I bought a vehicle. I bought a RM250 Suzuki dirt bike. And then when I met my husband, Steve, he had jet skis. And I saw jet skis at Newport Beach. Two guys put them in the water. And they were jumping waves and laughing. And they weren't falling down and giving up. On a dirt bike, if you fell with those metal tanks, because they were really heavy bikes then, suspension wasn't so good. You might break a foot peg, you might have to get a new handlebar, might dent your fuel tank, not good. But on this jet ski, this stand-up jet ski, oh my gosh, you could flip, fall, swim back to it, get up, and keep going, and laugh. I had to have one of those. I went and I bought one for $1,600 out the door in Newport Beach. And then it was on. And that's where my story comes in. So all those historical lineages of my family brought me to this today. Without their involvement, I would not have this opportunity. There is no way anywhere in the world a female like me could exist except the United States of America. And what happened is this jet ski product that was made by Clayton Jacobson and sold to Kawasaki Motor Corporation, revolutionized boating. In some ways, not so good. Some of the operators really need to get off these boats and get some education. We all know who they are, and it's embarrassing to our community, but there's also some amazing, wonderful, incredible things that are going place forward, the life-saving. So I started to race in 1980. I became pro, and in 1989, through BC Racing at Long Beach Memorial Stadium, I started doing boating safety courses with BC Racing. And Brad Southworth was one of my mentors, who was one of the founding fathers of water rescue using jet skis. So that's the movement that I got into. I'm a first-generation jet skier in the 1970s. I am still riding jet skis, but primarily my company trains people all over the world how to use Kawasaki Ultra LX jet skis, preferably because they're the most steady and stable ones for rescue and patrol. I've been blessed to work with Yamaha Motor Corporation, who really helped in the early days, and Bombardier Sea-Doo. These three companies encompass the personal watercraft platform that helps occupational users like lifeguards, fire rescue, law enforcement, and volunteer search and rescue teams to go out and save lives on rivers, lakes, and the ocean all over the world. Interesting fact is that recreational riders actually are performing amazing rescues. If you just saw Hurricane Dorian in the Bahamas, the men there that were rescuing hundreds of people with their Yamaha Wave Runners did incredible service and definitely saved lives. And this is happening all over the world in flood situations. So this boat has revolutionized life-saving, and I've been very fortunate to be a developer and a pioneer, but I didn't do it alone. So all my ancestors are there. Everybody that works at Kawasaki Motor Corporation has put into this. Every person that creates the product and puts their hand on it and touches it. It's a huge community of people with goodwill. And then my instructors. My company is in 11 countries, and we have amazing instructors who have the same dedication and desire to help others. And what we do is we have classes that we teach in all types of waterways. So we go in swift water, in rivers. We work in open oceans during storms at night. We work in surf zones, and we work in large wave events like big wave surfing. So K38 is the name of my company, which is Kilometer 38 in Baja, Mexico, is what it was named after. And the company was originally called Watercraft Awareness Safety Program in 1989. And Yamaha approached me and wanted me to help push out the safety for their programs. And they brought me on board, and they cultivated a very strong mindset. And at the same time, the Personal Watercraft Industry Association was doing the same thing with Sea-Doo and Kawasaki, the three partners. And at that time, also Polaris. They were working very hard through their public safety law loan program to get effective training so that they would understand that this was an occupational boat that could be used to assist the public in a time of need. That program was absolutely brilliant, and I was very fortunate to be a part of that. So with that, all these people, you know, that aren't going to get named here have revolutionized life-saving, and that was one of my goals early on. But it happened because of being here in Southern California. If I didn't live here in Orange County, if my family didn't migrate here, I would not have been exposed to the jet ski. And so it's just amazing how things kind of line up. You know, I always knew I'd be working around water because my younger sister, Andrea, had died very young, and that had kind of influenced my attitude about the trauma and the pain and the suffering that families go through in children. My sister died of spinal meningitis in bed with me and my brother Eric, and she was 2.5 years old. So her life really is sort of an extension of the enthusiasm that I have to do good and to help others to hopefully not go through a life-altering catastrophic event before our time. You know, like the water, the survival rate's not very good. So we have to have a game plan when we hit to the water. And one of that is preparation. And a lot of people just want to go because, again, they need an adrenaline flush. They work hard all week. They want to take it easy. They need to get away from things. And water is definitely a magnet of fun. But it also can be quite dangerous and dark. So K38 was born. Then I got together through Yamaha Motor Corporation. They asked me to work with a lifeguard in Encinitas, Larry Giles. And we started to work in Southern California, putting programs together for a little bit better organized. And he actually created or wanted to do the night qualification. That was really his idea. He really was a forward-thinking person in terms of his belief on the personal watercraft. I had a lot of the technical knowledge. I had the race background and the industry background. But I'd also done a lot of rescues. And so what I did is I put together the concepts of understanding the craft, knowing the waterways, and how people get into trouble and how to keep a stable, steady, and level boat. And basically, we created the standard. And then K-38 started to really take off and build ground around 1998. 1996 through 1998, it was kind of the formative years all over the world for the personal watercraft rescue program. So I've been really fortunate with K-38 to have the industry support and confidence and trust. And that says a lot to me about how they feel about their product, the people that build it. They really believe in the product. I believe in it as a modern life-saving tool. And certainly we have saved thousands of lives ourselves as trainers, but our students, my goodness, they have taken this as the next generational positive movement of creating good in the world. And that all happened here, you know, just from prison, a boat trip across the Atlantic, struggling to form a colony, not dying, not killing ourselves. And an interesting thought is this. Think about this. So doing my genealogy research, I have newspapers.com. You can go on there and pull up newspapers back into the 1600s, all the way to Europe. And I was researching our Quivy family name. And one of our ancestors, interestingly enough, there was quite a few news articles in the 1800s about this Quivy boy, who's an ancestor, who one of the rivers in Ohio was kind of coming up rapid in flood stage, and there was four boys, and they decided to swim across this river on a dare. My ancestor said no, and another boy said no, and two boys were pushing them and putting peer pressure on them. You know, hey, you're a sissy. Oh, come on, you're scared. You know, that thing, right? My ancestor stood his ground out of fear and respect for the water because he knew he was not a strong swimmer. And the river was running much stronger than it had any other time they'd swam across. He stood his ground and he didn't surrender to their chiding. The two boys took off swimming, got out into the mid-channel current, and began the process of drowning in front of my ancestor and the boy who decided not to go. But then the boy who decided not to go, in a panic emotionally and out of fear of what he saw in front of him, the trauma and the terror of seeing his friends drowning, swam out and he drowned as well. My ancestor ran back to the town and put the alert out. Now think about that. We're all here because one of our ancestors did not kill himself prematurely, did not have a traumatic accident. And that's the moral of this story, is that he did something right. He listened to his intuition. I've based my entire business off of that model, and it served me really well. Not to overreach, to stick to my guns, know before I go or before I tow, meaning boat work, or driving the truck and the trailer, being prepared, being ready to take on what is before me. And that's something I'd like to leave you with and to think about throughout your ancestry, people you don't even know. They're in your DNA, they're in your blood, they're in your flesh, they're somewhere in the recess of your mind, but their intelligence and their reasoning and their common sense is how you're here today, how we're all here today, because if they were reckless or negligent or didn't listen to nature, didn't pay attention, didn't respect what was in front of them. Our stories, we may not be sitting here today listening to this. And I really love that thought. We don't know where our thoughts are coming from. Sometimes I think they're ancestral. You know, that deja vu moment, or like, I think I've been here before. So I listen to that. It's really helpful for me. And I use it in my work. My work is really wonderful. I'm the only woman in the world doing what I've just discussed with you. And I have to give a lot of thanks to this country. And as you can see, the enthusiasm about how grateful I am. For me, it's a spiritual responsibility to have compassion and kindness and common sense so that you can thrive and survive and to be strong and to do the right thing and pick up the garbage on the ground and smile at people. And if somebody's bad at coming bad at you, don't let them get too close. Keep them away. Selection is the most important thing. So even in my work, that serves me well. Perspective, selection, and situational awareness. Because I believe that's how my ancestors lived their life. I don't have the direct connection to the homeland anymore. So I've had to take the snippets of wisdom. My great-grandpa Joseph, when I was 4.5 years old, sat me down on the doorstep on Flores Street in the clapboard house that he built. And he told me one thing that was very important. He said, "You will always vote. We're here because we are free, and you will always vote. Repeat that after me." And I said, "I will always vote." And he said, "Say it 10 more times." And I did. And then he said, "You will tell your children the same thing, and you must never forget this, or you must leave this country." And I've never forgotten that. And everything I do, I apply my great-grandpa's wisdom to. He was also a beekeeper, so I also apply his honey-making skills to everything that I do. You know, don't forget that good stuff, too. So with that, my business is a part of my ancestry. It's a part of America. It's a part of all the people that are the builders and shakers and movers and designers and creators, the artists of life. The people that care, the people that are bringing something to the table and not taking things off the table, but they're filling the table up with goodness. I would like to encourage you to share the same message from your own experiences to those that you care and that you know, and to remain grateful and thankful, and to find a spiritual gratitude. For definitely this country was built on the premise of God bless America for great reasons, so that we could resist the dark side that we all possess, and to build more on the opportunity of what is good. It's a fight to do that. It's a beautiful fight. You know, here in America, we owe a debt to the rest of the world to show them how much we care for this country, because we definitely are living in the land of luxury, and we didn't earn it. My ancestors gave this to me, this opportunity. The Native Americans that came across the Russian Strait and worked their way across, or came in boats, they shared it, gave it up, surrendered. A lot of people died for this country. There's a lot of bloodshed in this country. And don't forget that. When I came to the military training, Vince McLeod was running the First Force Recon program for life-saving during their surf passage training, and they had a Marine that was seriously injured. I came into training the United States military through that Marine's injury and through Vince McLeod finding a solution and taking the initiative to trust me and to work with me, which was amazing as a female. I owe him a lot of gratitude. I've trained now for 30 years, United States military. It's amazing. I can't believe that I'm that person, but that Marine that got injured, that program literally is written in blood. Working at Mavericks, working at Killers and Todos Santos, Larry Giles got that door opened up. That was his call to go down to Killers and work with a gentleman named Gary Linden, who had the vision for the Big Wave World Tour that he put together. He worked with the International Surfing Association, and from there, I was able to work with the United States Coast Guard Rescue Swimmer Program. I have trained the elite in this country because of trust and because of capability and working hard. I study all the time. I work harder than anybody else in my community. And I'd suggest that you put 50% more into everything that you do, and the rewards in your soul will be so expansive that when it's your time to leave, there'll be no regrets. You lived your life well. You took advantage of the opportunity. You worked hard. You suffered. You know, nobody gave me a leg up, but people trusted me, and that gave me encouragement. So be good to yourself. Be kind to others. Work hard. Give more. Don't be lazy. Laziness is an excuse to not perform. So With that, if you go look at my name on the internet, you can see some of the amazing things that people have given my company opportunities. And I know that that's just going to grow. We have more and more flooding happening worldwide. We want to be a catalyst of hope for those in peril. My instructors are dedicated to the same mission, and so are K-38 coxswains who operate these amazing Kawasaki jet skis. And we are really going to work very hard at inspiring and mentoring the next generation. Just like family DNA, this is our family tree. So I just want to thank you for listening to what I had to say and what I wanted to share about my family and about my belief as an American, as a woman. And hey, another thing, I don't really believe in discrimination. I believe in opportunity. I've had plenty of discrimination and I love it. It just motivates me to get ahead of it and try harder and figure out how to get the program out there to help people. Because really, if you think about it, you just can't stop. Just never quit. Never stop. Don't feel sorry for yourself. Keep looking towards the horizon. Aim high. Pohaku, my dear friend in Hawaii, he would always say, look to the horizon and beyond. And that is really wise words, right? And we all could use a dose of positive. But with positive comes negative. Got to balance the two out. One doesn't exist without the other. So keep your spirit in the middle. And just be enthusiastic about this amazing life that we have, because it truly is amazing. I have 3 minutes and 30 seconds remaining, but this is long enough. I want to say goodbye. God bless all you. God bless America, and God bless your family and your DNA.